Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, May 14, 2015. A top U.S. diplomat in South Sudan is calling on the warring parties to stop fighting immediately.
We would like them to silence the guns. We want both sides to adhere to what they've already agreed to so many times. We cannot achieve peace if we continue to fight. We must silence the guns. What we mean is we need to save lives.
And South Sudan's ruling party is calling on the sons and daughters of the country to work for peace.
Don't expect the government alone to resolve all this. We, as South Sudanese, we must take responsibility of the development of our country.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The United States is strongly condemning the latest surge in fighting in South Sudan and calling on the two sides in the long-running conflict to resolve their differences and prevent more loss of life. Charlton Doki spoke with U.S. Chargé d'Affaires in Juba, Michael McCarthy, and sent this report.
We would like them to silence the guns. We want both sides to adhere to what they've already agreed to so many times. We cannot achieve peace if we continue to fight. We must silence the guns. What we mean is we need to save lives.
McCarthy says the U.S. government is deeply concerned by reports of heavy fighting in Unity and Upper Nile states. He says U.S. officials are working to determine who is responsible for reported human rights abuses committed during the recent surge in fighting.
What we're hearing are reports from dependable sources and multiple reports that corroborate each other of abuses being committed in this offensive into Unity State, such as the targeting of civilians, the burning of civilian homes, rapes, and the kidnapping and conscription of children. We're not accusing anyone at this point. What we're saying is we need to shine a light to find out if these reports are true.
The United States early this week released a statement calling on the South Sudan government to allow what it calls protection actors to inspect sites where rights abuses are alleged to have occurred. The United States listed those sites as the villages of Nialdew, Wathjak, and Nimni in Unity State. U.S. officials say they have had reports of thousands of civilians being displaced by the latest violence. They also say there are troubling reports that humanitarian workers and United Nations mission in South Sudan or UNMISS have been prevented from accessing civilians in areas where the fighting is raging. McCarthy says both sides in the conflict must allow humanitarian relief workers unhindered access to civilians affected by the fighting.
First, we need to silence the guns, because they can't have access if there's active fighting going on. Both sides have agreed so many times to cessations of hostilities. Both sides should put the people first and stop the fighting. That allows the humanitarian organizations and the protection workers to get into the area and do what they need to do to save lives and to work with the people.
The two sides in South Sudan's conflict signed a cessation of hostilities agreement in January last year. They have recommitted to it several times since then, but each time the fighting has continued unabated. The most recent clashes erupted in the two oil-producing states as President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar met in Addis Ababa for what was supposed to be the final round of talks to restore peace in South Sudan. The talks ended in early March without a deal. McCarthy says the latest uptick in violence in South Sudan is particularly troubling.
What especially concerns us this time? Two things. Number one, the size and scope of what we're hearing. These are horrific, horrific incidents on a very, very large scale in multiple sites. Number two, this just adds one more block to the road to unity and reconciliation. This is one more big pile that stands in the way of peace and that stands in the way of reconciliation. which is very discouraging at this time.
McCarthy says the U.S. government is working with the rest of the international community to ensure the warring parties end the fighting and return to the negotiating table. He says the United States also backs the creation of an impartial justice mechanism to ensure that people who committed the atrocities that have been reported throughout the conflict in South Sudan are held to account. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
Jonglei state authorities are warning that hunger could be imminent unless the World Food Program reverses its decision to cut in half its food donation to the state. South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission is also calling on WFP to increase its food support in Jonglei. Jacob Achek has more for VOA from Juba.
According to South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, or SSRRC, the vast majority of people living in three of Jonglei State's counties believe their home during the 17-month-old conflict. SSRRC says more than 45% of those who have returned to Bor County since the fighting began are officially classified as food insecure. SSRRC coordinator James Jokalier says that without immediate intervention from humanitarian agencies, the situation will become dire, especially if the World Food Program continue its reduced food distribution in Jonglei.
I believe that hunger situation in the state will be an alarming situation soon. Recently, we received a very negative information from WFP. They reduced food from 100% to 50%. Distribution this month is going to be 50% ratio. So food security situation is totally bad.
Jongalier, who spoke on behalf of the SSRRC director, says WFP and Catholic Relief Services, or CRS, has provided most of the assistance to people in Jonglei State. But Jongalier says, quote, CRS food is meant for creating assets. By that, I mean people must be willing to work in exchanging for CRS food supply. Dao Akoy Jurkuch, the commissioner of Tujis County, says the amount of food being distributed by WFP is about 15 grams of sorghum per day per person, which does not last very long.
Now we have identified that there will be hunger in the county because the food that are going to be distributed by the World Food Program, that is funded by the SADO and JAM, it is better that they cannot go for the 15 days. So we identify that there will be hunger unless the World Food Program to increase the ratio.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization says it cannot reach part of Jonglei State with food aid because of the ongoing insecurity. Seja Tisho is the FAO interim representative in South Sudan.
The shipment has been stopped due to the fact that the conflict is ongoing. It's an heavy conflict. In this area, it's impossible for the time being to reach a population due to security. It's unfortunate because there are more or less 100,000 people that need some humanitarian assistance, and we will not be able to reach them for the time being.
Another factor contributing to the hunger crisis is the limited access to food market caused by part of the scarcity of U.S. dollar in the country. Most South Sudanese rely on imported food from other countries. Jock Allier says most traders can no longer supply this good because they doesn't have a currency to buy the goods. On top of that, Jong Alier says the planting season was virtually non-existent over the first year.
Last year, there was zero harvest as a result of the conflict in the area. The host community were not confident that they will stay in the area, and because of that lack of confidence, they failed to cultivate. So the harvest last year was zero, and the majority of people were depending on food that are being supplied outside the country.
Jonglei State Minister of Agriculture, Mayen Ngora Atim, confirmed the last year's harvest was very poor and said this year's harvest likely wouldn't be much better. Jokinzi's starvation will also occur in part of Ayut, Nyirol, Pangak, and Akobo counties if food assistance is not ramped up quickly. We reached out to the WFP spokesperson in South Sudan for comment, but did not hear back. Jonglei officials are calling on international aid agencies to increase their effort as the cultivation period approaches so that IDPs and host communities are less vulnerable next year. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Juba.
South Sudan's ruling Sudan People Liberation Movement says it is committed to ending the internal struggle for party leadership that triggered the country's 17-month-old conflict. SPLM Acting Secretary General Ann Ito told reporters that a deal signed in January to reunify the party has hit a snag, but is still on track. Philip Thornaleo reports for VOA from Juba.
Nearly 4 years since gaining independence from Sudan, Ito says South Sudan is in the very early stages of nation building. But she says that instead of focusing on building schools and health centers and ensuring everyone in South Sudan has clean drinking water, SPLM leaders have been too busy debating internal party reforms. And she says the conflict that broke out in December 2013 has dim the dreams of South Sudanese for a bright future.
I'm not proud of conflict because it's retarding our development. It's keeping our people back. Instead of people enjoying and contributing to nation building, they are in camps or running or trying to escape, and that takes us back from our vision.
Ito says South Sudan's worsening economic situation means there is an urgent need for the country's leaders to focus on ending the war and preventing more suffering. She says efforts are already underway to revive the economy.
Transformation of the economy. It means we have to look at everything. Productivity in the area of agriculture, market system, you know, even training of extension workers, training of tractor drivers and mechanics, and all those are the ones that would result in improved economy. And in the SPLM, we have a policy, but we are going to be reviewing it to make sure that it can address the current challenges that is being faced by our country.
Ito says if the SPLM is able to reunify and reform itself, it will help with supports to revive the economy and end the conflict in South Sudan. The fighting that broke out 17 months ago in Juba before spreading to several other states has claimed at least 10,000 lives and displaced around 2 million people. Ito says a reunification deal signed in the Tanzanian town of Arusha in January by the three factions of the SPLM is a step toward ending the broader conflict in South Sudan. She says a follow-up meeting held this week in Victoria, South Africa, is another sign that the party is determined to end its internal rifts and the still ongoing conflict.
We may begin seeing maybe their delegation coming here and working out a time frame, a timetable for the debates on how to transform some of the situation that exists today.
The SPLM split into three factions when the country erupted in fighting in December 2013. They are the ruling party faction led by President Salva Kiir, the SPLM in opposition, which is led by former Vice President Riek Machar, and the SPLM former detainees, led by former Secretary General of the SPLM, Pagana Amom. Few details have emerged from the Pretoria meeting, but it is known that the faction led by Machar did not attend. Ito says the party political bureau, which is the highest decision-making body of the SPLM, will meet to study what was agreed in Victoria and decide on the way forward. Ito says he strongly believes the SPLM will restore peace and carry out necessary reforms to boost development. She urged the South Sudanese people to take an active role in rebuilding their country, starting now.
Don't expect the government alone to resolve all this. We, as South Sudanese, we must take responsibility of the development of our country. We should not begin thinking, the NGOs are here. No country develops as a result of the support from NGO. It is those country and those country alone that must accept responsibility of change and development.
The SPLM is the political offshoot of the Sudan's People Liberation Army, or SPLA, which was founded on May 16, 1983, when Southern Sudanese soldiers fired the first gunshots in the two-decade war with Khartoum. The SPLA became the National Army of South Sudan, and the SPLM, the ruling party, when the country became independent in 2011. For VOA News, I am Philip Thornaleo in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, police are investigating mysterious killings in western Bahr el Ghazal state. That story when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you have friends in other countries and how do you communicate with them?
Yeah, I do have friends in other countries. I have one friend in the USA and other in Australia. I do talk to them on Skype, Tango, and also on Facebook.
I have some few friends in Sweden, in London, in America, but we communicate through Skype. Because it's better to communicate with someone physical than making phone calls.
I have them, yeah. I have friends in Uganda. The most means of communication is mobile phone, and the other one is Facebook accessibility. These are the means of communication that we use for connecting up.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Western Bahr el Ghazal state authorities are investigating another unresolved murder, this time of a village teacher. It happened near Bushiri Bridge, about 20 kilometers west of Wau town. This follows Monday's early morning murder of Paramount Chief Angelo Bagare and his wife. Dimo Silva has the story for VOA from Wau.
The slain teacher, whom locals identified as Taban Paul, also known as Paul Segi, was shot dead yesterday at around 2 p.m. in Bushiri. Locals say that when they arrived at the scene, about 2 hours later, they saw his body lying on the ground. Benjamin Fernando, one of Taban's village friends, says it was difficult to recognize the Jomoi primary school teacher at first because he was shot in the head.
We went to the scene only to find the man shot dead, but we don't know who shot him. By that time, it was around 4 to 5 o'clock. The police who arrived at the place decided to call for the car to carry the body.
Benjamin says Taban had just bought a new bicycle, which he suspects the assailant stole from his friend. Bushiri Chief Agustino Abdallah says cattle keepers may have been involved in the killing. Locals say Taban was killed on his way back from paying his condolences to the family of the late Paramount Chief Angelo Bagare, who was shot dead in his home just a few days earlier, along with his wife. Officials believe the suspect is someone who lives nearby. Agustino Abdallah is Bushiri Chief where the man was killed.
The information we got yesterday was that the killer carried the gun and the bicycle. The teacher who was killed is my citizen here. He lives in Raba Village.
Chief Agustino says a female farmer told police that on her way to her fields, she saw an armed man standing by the roadside minutes before the shooting. Authorities would not say whether they believe the killing of the teacher and the murder of the paramount chief are connected. Western Bahr el Ghazal's acting police commissioner, Deng Malwal, does say the anonymous suspects are likely to be experienced robbers.
We are securing the town day and night. The issue happened yesterday, and we brought the body to the mortuary while the investigation continues.
Authorities are investigating another shooting that occurred on Monday. A gunman opened fire on a school girl in the nearby Namatinda area of Wau County. The man reportedly tried to rape the girl when she managed to run away. The girl was not wounded. No suspect has been arrested. The Wau County Commissioner could not be reached for comment on the shootings or the attempted rape. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio, reporting in Wau.
A new initiative has been launched to block UN peacekeepers from being granted immunity when accused of sexual exploitation and abuse. At least 50 such alleged incidents occurred last year, but Code Blue campaign supporters say the actual number is probably much higher. VOA's Joe DiCapua has the story.
The UN has admitted that sexual abuse by peacekeepers is a problem and that it has a zero-tolerance policy toward it. But Paula Donovan, co-director of AIDS Free World, says that policy is not enough.
both by the UN's own accounts and by anecdotal accounts and information coming from the field and from people within the UN system who don't feel at liberty to speak publicly, we know that the problem is actually much more severe than the UN is reporting to the General Assembly.
Donovan says UN claims are not backed by the evidence.
Each year the Secretary General reports on the numbers of allegations of sexual exploitation and abuse and claims that the problem is slowly but surely being solved. In fact, our research shows that that's not the case at all, that the problem is quite extensive, that the UN does not report in the most accurate or transparent ways about the problems that come to their attention.
AIDS Free World is joined in the Code Blue campaign by Grasa Michelle, who led a 1996 study of sexual exploitation of children in armed conflict. Retired Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire, who commanded the UN mission during the Rwanda genocide. African Women's Development Fund CEO Theo Sowa, and former UN Undersecretary General Anwarul Chowdhury. Donovan says justice is not being served when the UN investigates sex abuse allegations against peacekeepers.
We decided to try to determine where the breakdown starts, and what we learned was that it's a chain reaction that actually stems from the fact that under a 1946 convention, UN staff, police, and experts on mission and peacekeeping missions have immunity. So we're calling for the end to what we are perceiving as a misinterpretation of a very old convention.
She says immunity was originally meant for diplomats, but is now being applied to accused criminals.
So we will also be calling for a complete and thorough commission of inquiry, independent entirely of the United Nations, that will look at what's broken within the system and not only how it needs to be fixed, but who is responsible and who needs to be held to account for the dreadful way that these cases are handled, covered up, and misrepresented to the public.
Naming the campaign Code Blue, she says, is not just because the UN operates under a blue flag.
In the United States and some other countries, when all efforts have failed to keep a patient alive and the patient is going into cardiac arrest in a hospital, an announcement is made throughout the hospital, Code Blue in room such and such, and all who can help to keep the patient alive rush to the scene and help to resuscitate the patient who's near death. So we feel as though we're at that point with the United Nations.
The Code Blue campaign calls for amending the 1946 Convention on the Privileges and Immunities of the United Nations. It says the convention should exclude sex-related crimes from the immunity granted to UN personnel. Another option, says Donovan, is to have the Secretary General issue a policy bulletin of the convention that reflects today's realities.
That immunity should never have been in place or applied where these particular accusations are concerned. And you have the double standard here. You can't say you have zero tolerance for sexual exploitation and abuse, but you're tolerant enough to have the presumption of immunity when someone is accused.
Campaign organizers deny the effort will harm UN operations. They say it will strengthen the reputation and credibility of a critical UN function. Accusations of sexual abuse have been leveled against French and African peacekeepers in Central African Republic after an internal UN report was leaked in April. The United States has called for an inquiry into how the UN dealt with the allegations. The report says alleged abuses against children occurred between December 2013 and June of 2014. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Powers, says if the allegations are true, it would be a profound violation of the dignity and physical security of individuals in their most vulnerable state. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And we now move to Burundi, where explosions and gunfire can be heard in the capital of Burundi, a day after a top general launched a coup attempt while the president was out of the country. It remains unclear who is in control of the country as daily political protests in Bujumbura appear to have given way to clashes between rival political factions. VOA's Gabe Joslo reports from Bujumbura, where he is, that hearing gunfire from headquarters of the ruling CNDD-FDD political party.
The shooting began overnight and intensified by daybreak Thursday as military factions loyal to the president battled dissident forces. Police maintained a heavy presence near the headquarters of the ruling party, the CNDD-FDD. A local resident who asked not to be named told VOA the situation is dangerous for civilians.
We tell them we go at work, but they shoot us directly without anything, without asking where are you going. Just they shoot us.
Another resident, Ngugusoni Buyenzi, said he too was confronted by the police. The police are guarding the area, he said. Anyone who tries to cross over are told to go back. By afternoon, the streets of the capital were deserted. Soldiers in uniform were out guarding some of the key traffic circles and intersections in the city as gunfire could be heard from different directions. On a side street near the Interior Ministry, a soldier lay dead in the road. Soldiers told the Reuters news agency that he was a soldier from the pro-coup forces. Much of the fighting has centered around the state broadcaster that went off air briefly during the day after broadcasting a message from President Pierre Nkurunziza declaring he was still in control of the country. A pro-coup spokesman, Zeno Ndabaneze, told VOA's Central Africa service the station is still in control of loyalist factions after dissident soldiers withdrew. Other private radio stations were also attacked and burned during the course of the day. Mr. Nkurunziza left the country on Wednesday to attend a regional summit in Tanzania to discuss the political crisis in Burundi. The attempted coup, announced by former Burundian intelligence chief Godefroy Niyombare, follows weeks of street demonstrations against the president's decision to run for a third term in office. Opponents say a third term would violate the constitution and a peace agreement that ended the country's 13-year civil war. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Bujumbura.
And that report from Joselo in Bujumbura brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Ayan Tamohaba by Sultan Clinton.
We have been listening to Sultan Clinton with the song Ayan Tamohaba. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus. from the Voice of America.
Hallelujah. I beg me, Papa, me, Mama, waiting to see you.